Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truths listeners. Get ready for a compassionate conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Compassion, as in deep awareness of the suffering of another, with the wish to relieve that suffering. Addiction is a chronic, relapsing, yet treatable disease of the brain. If you talk to people who are addicted to drugs, they will admit that they wish they were free from the shackles of drugs. They don't like it. They just feel they have no choice. People with addiction want compassion and a path to treatment and recovery. There's a difference in opinion on the best approach to that problem. There's an extreme that says we should meet people where they are, and by that they mean leaving them there and allowing them to use drugs if that's what they want to do, keeping them in the shackles. Some want to remove the stigma of using drugs, the drugs themselves, not just removing the stigma off the person with a disease. This de facto means normalizing drug use. I believe people with these extreme views do it in the name of compassion, but their compassion is misplaced. Enabling drug use, delaying treatment is not compassionate. It's cruel. It robs people from incentives and deterrence to turn their life around. Who has the right opinion on compassionate approaches to people who suffer from addiction? An important point of view is the view of people who are in long-term recovery, people who lived in the shackles and got free. To learn more about compassion for people with substance disorder, I reach out to Cedric Akbar. Cedric Akbar is a San Francisco-based community leader and a passionate advocate for recovery and prison reentry. Cedric serves as the Director of Forensic and Recovery Services at Westside Community Services. He is a founding member of Positive Directions Equal Change, an advisor to Drug-Free Sidewalks, and was elected to the San Francisco Democratic County Central Committee in 2024. To learn more about Cedric Akbar, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Cedric on July 3rd, 2025. Cedric Akbar, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate it. And it feels good to be welcome somewhere. So thank you so much.
No, I've been excited for and looking forward to this conversation because you've had a very interesting path to getting to where you are today. I think you've had a journey with drugs and hardship, and now you're changing the world. So tell us about that.
Well, it is a long road. I never thought in my life looking at it today, every place that I was in my addiction, it seems that God has put me in a place where I'm there to serve him and serve others. I originally had a 20-year addiction to heroin. And the only thing that ever sent me to incarceration in prison is my heroin addiction, trying to support that. And for me personally, I know by going to be locked up, that's what made me come to a realization that the only thing that was sending me to prison was me committing crimes to use drugs. And if I stop possibly using drugs, I'll stop going to prison. And from there, I wrote to every program imaginable and nobody would take me. And I had to go do my time. And one of the, I think I had a case in every county in the Bay Area. And I was in Marin County. And the judge said he had no problem with me going to a program. And then they talked to the district attorney. And he said, I don't have a problem with Mr. Akbar going to a program either. After he give us these 10 years, he can go to any program he wants to. And my little heart just sunk at that moment. But from that moment, it also made me realize that I had to make a change in my life. And at the time I went to prison then, it was really no treatment programs or anything in prison. So it was almost like the Malcolm X days of picking up whatever I could read in prison from the Bible and the dictionary and just start studying to make the necessary changes in my life. And that has brought me to a place where I never thought I would. It just warms my heart on how God works in your life. And everything that I had touched during addiction, I have worked from methadone, I have worked in the jails, I've worked in the prisons, worked in programs, working with people that was just like myself and being able to assist them to help them to get back on their feet and reintegrate in society and become taxpaying citizens. And it's just been, and also get paid to do what the churches are supposed to be doing. And that's serving and helping those that need the help.
That's the added bonus.
Yes.
They say people who end up with a substance use disorder, with an addiction, a lot of that is from childhood trauma. Did you have childhood trauma that led to that?
I never thought I had childhood trauma. But I mean, I guess after the fact, when people talk about it, I guess it was trauma. But I look at it more for me was the contradiction of the world and the contradiction of the way I grow up. Because, you know, you were taught, don't steal, don't take things, don't do any of that. But yet and still, you would see people buying hot stuff from people to get the discount. You would see people doing just the complete opposite of what they were telling you to do. And I know for me personally, that's what really got me where I was always, I couldn't understand it. And then the other thing I learned is when I'd go places with uncles, go places with any older person, how I could get to continue to go with them and reap the benefits of going with them is had to keep my mouth shut. So whatever they were doing, I couldn't go back in the house or whatever house it is and couldn't say that. And I did have things that happened in my life. I didn't call it trauma at the time. You know, my mother left me at an early age, so I was raised by a grandmother who couldn't read or write.
So, you know, having your mom leave you and being raised by a grandma, that sounds like trauma to me.
Well, I mean, looking back, and I guess what you would call it, you say that's trauma. I just looked at it more that was a way of life because I wasn't the only one that grew up in my neighborhood that had one parent or had no parents or had grandparents raising you. So was it normal? No, it wasn't normal. But like I said, I'm looking at it from this point now. Early on, yes, I would tell people in a program that was part of it. But the other side is looking back, I just look at it as it was a way in life for me to be able to persevere, to be able to learn how to grow, to be able to learn how to deal with situations. And it taught me a lot of things in the long run, which is helping me today. Because as I was growing up, I never thought as Black people in America that we had a culture per se, because I didn't know where the culture came from, because I took culture as a language, a group of people having, you know, all the things that culturally somebody else doesn't know. And then I had to realize that it was through my grandmother who couldn't read or write is where I learned my culture. And from that point on, I always said that I would always stand up and speak for those that are downtrodden, speak for those that have a hard time dealing with the language in America and all of those things. So, I mean, I just look at it as a period of where I could grow, looking at it in hindsight at this point, that I could grow and be the individual that I am today, to be able to be resilient, to be able to hear things from people, to be able to understand both sides, and to be able to put others first besides myself.
Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah, you're right. It creates who you are, even if it is, you know, not perfect. How old were you when you were first exposed to drugs, and what drug was it?
5 or 6 years old, heroin, because all my mother's siblings were on drugs or alcohol.
No. You were 5 years old using heroin?
No, I wasn't using it. You say exposed. I meant by exposure was that I saw it. No, when I first saw it, I always used to say I would never use anything like that because I saw then what it was doing. But my first exposure to it was alcohol. I would say alcohol was the first one because that was rampant in any household. And, you know, just take a nip of it. It wasn't like I was addicted to it. I just would drink it. And then next thing was marijuana. And marijuana was something that stayed with me for a long time.
How old were you when you first tried marijuana?
About 13 or 14. And at that time, you know, you had to be real secretive and we had the yellow papers and you had to go really and hide in places to be able to use because this was like the 60s, late 60s and early 70s. And but also growing up with the group of people I grew up with, we wanted to use every drug known to mankind at the time so we can know which this is the silliest thing in the world. Which drugs that we could handle and what could take us. And that's what I learned. I was only drunk two times. And after the second time, I say, I won't even drink alcohol. And that's when I fell in love with marijuana. And heroin, I had tried it. And the first time, that's the only drug I know that you use and it tells you don't use it anymore because I threw up and it's really telling you don't use it. So I tried it at an early age, like about 15 or 16, but I never did it. I waited until I was in my late 20s before I started using. I met this woman and I'm the one, well, she probably introduced it, but I know I'm the one that I stopped. I had got a job or something and I got her some heroin and I got me some cocaine, gave her some heroin because she said she had used it. And not too long after that, we both were using. And it was just a roller coaster ride. And the only thing with heroin, it was just maintenance and maintaining. You know, that was, you just didn't want to be sick, didn't want to be in pain, didn't want to feel all of that. And as, you know, you do heroin, that's when all of those, like you were talking about, of feeling the pain, feeling everything that you ever felt in your life, it would come up, especially during the times that you were sick and to think about it, because once you do the heroin, you say, I can be president the next day. But those were the times when you think about all the pain and the misery. And also the things that causes me to leave family, to leave friends, to hurt people. You know, like heroin made me, and I'm not going to blame it on the heroin. Cedric, I did it myself. I hurt people. I hurt a lot of people in my life, and it was a lot of damage. And let alone, so I couldn't deal with the damage of my childhood. I couldn't deal with the damage of anything that had happened to me beforehand because I kept creating too much damage for myself. And so it's like you had to keep going back, keep going back, keep going back. And that's just a vicious cycle that I just, I thank God that you took that away from me, right? Because I couldn't have done it.
Yeah. So your brain was hijacked by drugs. And when you were in jail, you had, you know, you were forced detox. And your brain cleared up.
Yes. But the thing, this is what happened though. And when I go to jail or go to prison, now you could get heroin and all that in jail. But the cost that you would have to pay, and I'm not talking about not only the financial costs, I'm talking about the drama of being in gangs or fighting, or if you owe somebody some money, what could possibly happen to you when you're in incarceration, always made me, I just wasn't going to use. But the thing is, no matter what I did, how long I was locked up, the longest period I ever been locked up is 5 years, which was the last one. But in between that was like 2 year stints. Year stints, or sometimes I'd get lucky and get out of the county jail within 90 days. But the issue is this, I have the best intentions to say that I'm not going to use when I get out, but I guarantee you, as soon as I hit R&R, which is the release, I could make myself sick immediately and say that I need to have heroin. But the other thing is, I had never at no point ever wanted to stop. So all I could do is as soon as I'm released, I couldn't wait to get back to heroin, even though I know what the end result was going to be, but I couldn't wait to get back to it. So,
That's kind of the definition of addiction. So
exactly.
What finally changed?
Like I said, this last time I knew I was facing at least 10 to 20 years. Mm. That's what I knew I was, because I had a case in every county in the Bay Area. And just back then, they had the Habitual Criminal Act, which means when you commit so many crimes, you get an automatic 10 years. So that's why I knew I was getting at least 10 years.
So deterrence got you. There was stronger deterrence.
And then I was sitting in a holding cell before I went to court, sitting in the cell by myself. And tears started coming out of I started crying. And I cried and cried, but no tears was coming out of my eyes. And then that's when I realized, I said, I never could possibly see my child again. And I had a daughter at the time. And I also had the feeling that I could actually die in here and never come back. And like I was telling you earlier, that's when I deduced that I got to stop committing crimes. And the only way I'm going to stop committing crimes is I got to stop using heroin. And that's what it was on. And I think when you think about those moments, like in the church, they talk about when you're saved. I really truly believe that was my saved moment. And I really truly believe that's when the light bulb came on for me that I didn't want to use anymore. Now, not wanting to use anymore was one thing. I went on and I did 5 years. And I wrote to every program, nobody would take me. And one program told me to come to them as soon as I got out. And I was released from Southern California and had to come back to San Francisco. And I got released on a Friday. And I went to that program, and it was a Friday afternoon. Of course, I know on a Friday afternoon, everybody wants to go home. And this person told me, he said that we can get you a hotel room and you come back on Monday. But I knew that meant a hotel room in the Tenderloin where everybody's using heroin. And I said, no, I cannot do that. And I finally told him, we're going back and forth. And he and I was the only two people in the building. And I told him, I said, you're going to have to call the police on me then. I said, because I'm not leaving. And he looked at me and he went on and put me in the program that same day. And even once I got into the program back then, you had to sit on this bench. And I sat on that bench from Friday until Monday. And I never forget that. And you couldn't look up. They would bring you food and you had to raise your hand. You had to go to the bathroom, but you couldn't look nobody in the eye. You had to look at the floor. Plus the chair that you sat in was sitting right next to the door. So if you wanted to leave, you just could get up and walk out. But finally on that Monday, which was Monday afternoon, they called me into this room and it was like a counselor and about 10 residents. And they asked me all these questions. And then on the last question, the counselor asked me, well, if we don't take you, what would you do? And that thought never had crossed my mind. And it scared the shit out of me. And that's what I told him. I said, you just scared the shit out of me. And I never thought of it like that because I just knew I was in. But they smiled. And I did. I signed up to do 6 months into the program, wound up staying there for 2.5 years to almost 3 years. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to learn how to be sober. I wanted to have my own place. And I wanted to have money in my pocket, meaning money in the bank. Those were the three priorities that I wanted to have leaving there. Now, when I completed this program, graduated this program, honestly, I still not had a clue of how I was going to stay sober. Because I thought the program, I said, okay, I guess when you graduate, they're going to tell you this secret thing of this is how you do it. And it wasn't until I met the group of people that I'm in now, Positive Directions Equals Change. I met this brother named Craig Johnson, who is my road dog to the end of to this day. And I sat in his office. He worked at the Northern California Service League. And he would get phone call after phone call. In a 15-minute period, he may get 12 phone calls. short and brief to the point. And that's when it kicked into me. That's what I have to do. I have to stay connected to people. And I know me, Cedric, I want to always do what I want to do. So instead of having a foot on my neck like a probation officer or a parole officer or incarceration or the program, I can put the own foot on my neck. And when I learned that, that's the connection that you have to make with people, that I have to open my mouth and let people know what's going on and what I'm doing to hold myself accountable. That's when it kicked in to me about how to stay sober. And it also, everything I learned in the program, it started to come to light as I was on the street. I mean, something as petty as jaywalking. You know, you don't do it because for me, it was like a permission of allowing myself to do things that I have no business doing. And what if I continue to do that? I keep letting those permissions get larger and larger until eventually I wind up doing something that I really will regret. But that's when it really kicked in for me, when I saw that. And then I saw that I needed people and I needed a group of people. And that's how we created our support group, Positive Directions Equals Change, which was a group of African-American men, all came from programs. And we saw people falling off as soon as they leave the programs, whether they stayed 1 year or 10 years. And we formed a support group to learn how to pay our bills, to learn how to even get a bill in our name, learn how to be parents, learn how to be husbands, and learn how to be individuals to each other. And we would meet like once a month have a group like we did in the program. Because like in NA, you have a meeting and they go and talk about themselves, but it's like not like feedback unless you talking to someone. But in our circle, we can talk to one another. And we never did anything alone. And that was the key for me to being able to stay sober. So that's why we created that environment. I'm sorry. We created that environment of Positive Directions, and that's the way we run our programs now. It's a family approach and being able to wrap our arms around people.
Cedric, you mentioned you had a daughter. Did something happen to your daughter?
No, I'm just saying at the time, because I got a daughter and a son. That's why. No, nothing happened to my daughter. Nothing at all. It's just that we develop our relationship. But even with that, like you was talking about trauma, you know, sometimes she acts just like me, not drug wise, but the distant part, you know, like, and I think that was part of the price I paid for it, you know, in that we talk and we get along. And if we see each other, it's just like we haven't been together. We've been together every day, but it's still, you know, sometimes I would like to see her a lot more than what I do.
Yeah.
And I'm sure vice versa for her.
It's nice. So I'm glad it's okay, because I was worried when you said that. I saw an article where you were quoted and you said, "We've been enabling drug use too long. It's time for compassion." So I want to talk a little bit about compassion and maybe tell us what you meant by that.
Okay, so I was saying that we enable people. I'm talking about San Francisco right now, even across the country. Mm-hmm. But what I meant by compassion also means we can tell people no. That's what I was talking about.
Right.
And today, people act like we can't tell people no. We act like we can't tell people no. You can't defecate on the street. No, you can't lay on this sidewalk and use drugs. No, there are kids in this park. Could you please remove yourself from this park and using drugs? No, you can't walk in a store and just take what you want anytime you want to, because there are consequences for your actions for doing that. And not only do you suffer, but the whole community suffers.
Right.
And that's what I was talking about. And for me, the thing I'm looking at today is we have created a world in the United States where everything is individualism. And what we come from approach is community-based, that because what I do affects you and everybody else that's around me, no matter what it is that I may be doing. So what we have to look at is the whole a lot of times, instead of all this individualism. And that's part of what I was talking about accountability, because nobody's held accountable anymore. People are allowed to do whatever they want to do, And what we do here in San Francisco is basically in which they have created a way where if you have open air drug markets, open use, people can come to this city and within a matter of 2 or 3 days, because of the homeless coalition, they can go to GA, General Assistance, and get them $300 or $400 cash and another $300 in food stamps. And it's on. And also, that's how you find housing, because if you're homeless on the street in San Francisco, which they keep saying homeless, which I believe 60 or 70% of it is addiction, it might even be more than that, that they'll put a person in housing due to housing first, because they're saying that's what the problem is. People are on the streets because, and they're using drugs because they're on the streets. But we've had more people die in housing than we have on the street.
Yeah. It's tragic, tragic.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So, you know, I hear what you're saying, and it reminds me of like being a parent. Sometimes you say no to your child, you know, don't cross the street in when the light is red, because you love them. And, right. And you need to say no. And you're right. It's like, oh, you're afraid to say no. Like everything is permissible. You know, there's a saying of meet people where they're at. And I think that that's what you're saying. It's like, okay, well, you're using drugs, so I'm meeting you there. So here's some drugs. But then on the other hand, like Congressman Patrick Kennedy says, if you meet people where they are, you don't want to keep them there. People who have a severe addiction, they don't want it. So well, meeting people where you are, does that mean just let you use drugs?
Not for me. Meeting people where you are, to me, means I'm going to give you some hope that you can live again, that you can mm-hmm. get up off of this street. When you come to us, I invite you, even before I do any intake paperwork, which is what this whole system is about now, to make sure they get their money first. But is I'm going to invite you in to be able to clean up, take a shower, eat, maybe lay down for a day or two or a couple hours. And then we can sit down and talk about what's the next step for you. But for me, it's going to be, I'd say it like this. Being a drug user or a drug addict is like or like kids. Because what we're looking for and what they're looking for is structure. And they're looking for the same thing that in that structure every day, something that they can count on. Because most people who are out there using don't trust anything or anyone. But what they can trust is a system that they know at this time I'm going to eat. No, I cannot go over there. I can smoke a cigarette at this time. I have to go to this group at this time. Now, they may grumble like your kids do at home. Kids grumble when the parents are being on them and telling them no. But the amazing thing I always found, even with children, somebody will call me and say, your daughter is so mannerable. And I'll be like, I don't ever get to see that. You know, but when they go out in public, they do it. And I've noticed that even when people, once they end the program and they look back in hindsight and say, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. And that people actually care about me. And that's something else that's missing, because that's where I believe meeting the person, because I'm always be straight. I'm a straight shooter. I don't lie to you. I'm not going to make up like this pie in the sky. And I'm going to say to you exactly what it is. I will give you the help you need, but also I'm going to also tell you no a lot of times. And I tell them, I say the first thing out of my mouth is going to always be no. I don't care what you want to do, because I can take back no, but I can't take back a yes. And it gives me time to think about what you said to me and the situation and taking each individual on a case by case basis. Which is sometimes difficult for people, because I have a set, I don't call them rules. We have a set of guidelines, and guidelines range for different people. So that's sometimes where you have to be flexible. And that's what, going back to my grandmother, I've learned things in my life that where I was so rigid or was treated so rigid. And I had to learn that you have to be flexible a lot of times in your life. And that's how, what I call meeting people where they are. But for me, it's always going to be a strict guideline. There is no use here under no conditions, marijuana, cigarette, none of that. We're not using in this facility. And we hold a line on that, and we hold a line on your behavior. There ain't no negative behavior jumping off either. Now, you're not going to get put out the program for either one, because if you use, we're just going to send you to a higher level of care, like a detox or a stabilization center. and then you can come back. And if it's anything but violence, violence is the only thing. But even then, if they have a violence, it's something that we possibly could understand. We may refer them to another program. But the other side is that no matter what behavior you have, we will deal with it.
So there's many ways of showing compassion, but still yes. having that red line saying we don't want you to use drugs.
When it's not tolerating that at right. any point.
And so you never say it's okay, just be careful. No. And then as far as, there's a whole stigma campaign where people who have a disease, a brain disorder of addiction, shouldn't have any stigma. But some people want no stigma on the drugs. Like, hey, it's okay to use heroin or cocaine.
I'm not there. And
I don't think you should be. I'm right with you.
I will never be in that place because
I don't think that's compassionate. I don't think.
No, it's not. And then the other side is it's like communities of color is the ones that really suffer from it. Now, something else about it, this fentanyl crisis, this is the first time that they have placed a white face on it. And I think sometimes that's another reason why everybody's talking about this compassion, because for the first time when white families have to be able to see their kids being addicted. So now everybody's talking about compassion. You know what I'm saying? And it wasn't like that during the crack epidemic. They was arresting grandmas, aunties, and all that. The crack epidemic destroyed families worse than slavery did almost.
Yeah. That was tragic. And it did have a different attitude. But I think the enabling that we see going on in the name of compassion, I think, is misguided. Right. So tell us about positive changes. Positive changes equals lifelong changes. That's a program for men, African-American men. And do they come straight from the jails and prisons to your program?
Well, at the time we started, they did. They came from prison and came from jails. That's the only people we really wanted to deal with at the time, because it mostly we dealt with violent offenders at first, because violent offenders couldn't get programs and when they were
so
in custody.
You fill that need that nobody else, just like you had, nobody wanted you.
Right.
Right.
But today, our program, we probably I would say about 40 to 50% African-American, but we have Asian, Latino, we have everybody in our program now. We never thought our model would fit everybody, but it did.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Tell us the principles of that model. Compassion, accountability is one of them. Tell us a little more.
Well, we always call it like a gumbo model. And I spoke about my grandmother. I take core values from being raised by a grandmother who took care of just about everything about your needs, told you the truth, didn't sugarcoat anything. And we kind of took the same model of showing people, again, it's like care. It's about building relationships with people. And I mean meaningful relationships. I don't mean just a superficial relationship. Because what I like to sit down with people, sometimes I ride and take people places to take them to appointments. When I used to be a case manager, I would take them to appointments. We'd talk. I would just let them talk. And when you just have a conversation and they start building safety and saying things to you, and then you see that they're not... we're not there to hurt you. It's a difference. It's even when we used to get people out of jail. We don't do it so much now because the jails have changed. But we used to get the people sizes, the clothes they wore, and make sure they had fresh clothes when they got out. And and we understood, one of the hurting things, and I know it's kind of going off, but I picked up this young lady one time. And at the time, I think she was about 19 or 20. And she sold drugs. She said sold crack. And she asked me to take her to see her mother. And I kept asking her where she lived. And she kept telling me, turn here, turn here. And where her mother lived was on a corner outside. And that was welcome home. And when I saw that, that just like, it made so much sense to me. So it's like, I'm dealing with a person who really don't trust nothing and nobody. And one of the reasons why this person is out here without her telling me, she would sell dope so her mother wouldn't have to go through all that stuff what most people had to go through. And she would always make sure her mother had it, which had her out there. So when I look at situations like that, it's like, I know at some point I become the uncle. I become the father that they didn't have. But I have to become that with, you know, real boundaries with it and have to be able to have that real conversation with a person. I know you may look at me like that, you know, because a lot of clients, they call me unk, they call me all, you know, like that's a term of endearment, though, like in the Black community. Yeah. But it's like doing that with having boundaries, but at the same time, having to be able to show that love and respect and being there for a person. So, and
although you understand that she needed to sell drugs in order to help her mother be off the street, and you know, so you have an explanation of how and why there's drug use, but you're still the firm and loving uncle saying this is not healthy for you.
Of course. Yeah. That's what I had to do. I really had to. Yeah. It was all, but I would see, this is what I do with guidelines. From the first time I meet you, I will continue to repeat them. And I will always ask you, tell me what part. This is the time for you to say what's comfortable for you or not comfortable for you. And so it helps me also to know in what areas where I have to be a little bit more gentle with you around this when I say it. Because I know the way I talk with a whole lot of passion and emotion. I sometimes raise my voice and I sound real authoritative. I know that. And so sometimes I have to put some cut on how I say things to people because some people take it a whole lot of different ways. So those are the type of things where, and I can't really like describe it all, but it's more of like a demonstration where people have to see it. And the main people that I want to know where our programs are the people that need our help. I guess this approach comes from two, is that I don't believe in titles. I don't believe in none of, I'm a servant. And I know for me personally, I'm a servant of God. And in order to serve God, I got to serve God's people. And I have to always remember that whoever I'm talking to, there goes I. And that was the same person. And I understand also the concept when God wants us to, he puts us in a position where we should be the ones understanding. And I don't never want to be one of those ones that forget where I came from or forget, you know, like where it was. And so, and even during this time in San Francisco, a lot of people want to say, well, just because that happened to you, I don't ever use that on anyone because I know everybody's circumstance is different. This is a new day and I'm not recommending nobody to do it how I did it. But I do know this. We have laws that exist on the books and those laws need to be addressed because this has gotten totally out of hand, especially in the city of San Francisco. And it's time for this to be corrected.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love your service and understanding and your humility that keeps driving you and the secret to your success, I think. And from what I'm hearing from you, the secret to success in recovery is the connection and being cared for that your community provides.
Yes. And, you know, because we call, like we sit in circles most of the time when we have classes or groups, and we call that the power source. And the whole key to the power source is staying connected, because if you get 20 or 30 people together, how much energy you have in that and how much you can be taken care of in that. But you can't disconnect from the power source, because when you disconnect, that's when you start to flail. But you also can't just keep coming back to the power source without not giving back to the power source.
You know, because it's also in the Bible that you need to be connected. The Bible, you know, God says that not to be alone, not to separate yourself from your community, but to stay, you know, with your community. So
right.
Another level. I saw something that you wrote that you said you don't like public schools. You want community schools. What does that mean? Wanted to know.
Well, this is what I say about public schools. I mean, I really don't have nothing.
You were talking about neighborhoods and the importance of neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing. Because, again, going back to people of color neighborhoods, to this day, if your parents are on probation or parole, you're really not allowed to go into the school. And which, you know, some schools be lenient with it because they understand the community. Also, that whole thing in the 60s and 70s of busing kids across and saying that they were going to get an education. Why can't you just bring the same education to the community? Those same kids could walk to school so they can be able to enjoy their community, so they can be able to create the family atmosphere that they need, so the store owners can know them. People who got the mom and pop stores, cleaners and all of that can be able to recognize, gives people a sense of community. And also of like the inferiority, you know, like lack of books, lack of teachers and all of that in poor communities. So most kids, especially you see it rampant in San Francisco, it's a gang of private schools, but all people with money send their kids to the private schools and the public schools suffer. They suffer the most. So, but in that, I'm about community. I'm about taking care of it. And I'm about for us to be able to work together as a community, because the kids, children in San Francisco are forgotten. I truly believe they've forgotten all over this country, but in San Francisco, they really are forgotten. And we do not take care of our children in San Francisco.
Oh, that's so sad to hear. That means you're going to get into drugs and you're going to have a pipeline. Because if you want to stop the pipeline of suffering, then it starts with children.
Exactly. And the children today. And then when you look at all the rules and guidelines, taking the power away from parents and giving it to kids, that's real dangerous when people don't have the structure or the means to be able to understand why and what for.
So, yeah. Oh, wow. Very interesting for you to say that. It's another topic, but I've seen that where government they feel like they can raise your child better than you can. I think that's a problem.
Exactly. Yeah. But yet still, the parent is responsible if something happens to them.
Yeah.
If they go to jail or whatever.
Financial and everything. Yeah, I know. I agree with you. And that goes to one of the projects that you're involved in that I absolutely love, drug-free sidewalks. Wow, who'd think of that? Like,
that was one of our supervisors, Matt Darcy, came up with the idea of drug-free sidewalks.
Oh, that's his idea. Wonderful.
Yeah, he came up with it and thinking that was another way, because he's also in recovery. And shout out to Matt. And he came to us, the recovery community, and asked us what we thought about it. And we thought it'd be a great idea because, you know, it's hard to, they still wanting to arrest people that were laying on the sidewalks, talking about kids again, kids on their way to school, and have to see that. And how does a parent explain that to their child, what they see? And when he said safe sidewalks, it was like nobody could really be against safe sidewalks. No one can be against the sidewalk is for everyone. And it was so amazing because it brought awareness up immediately, because we did it was an interview that was on a press conference that was on the sidewalk. And I saw some people coming down the street and they were walking and they had to go in the street. And I had to tell them, I say, safe sidewalks is for everyone. I know we were targeting people that were using drugs on the street. But it makes your awareness, like if you take it off of just the people that's using drugs and just put it on all of us, that's what makes the difference.
So who had to get off the sidewalk that wasn't using drugs?
Well, we were blocking the sidewalk because we were holding a press conference with a group of people. I had to tell everyone to back up and clear the way. Yeah, so you can allow people to be able to use the sidewalk. Yeah. And like I'm saying, light bulbs come on. And that's why I'm saying, because sometimes the targeted approach, people don't like a certain group of people or individuals to be targeted. But if you use it from an approach that the sidewalks are for everyone, that works. And so we have formed a good committee of some people on the San Francisco Democratic Party Central Committee, and they're working on it also. And we've been going out doing a lot of events, talking about this and getting the store owners in a lot of different neighborhoods. Of course, they're going to jump on board right away. And just to be able to get our sidewalks clear again. And that was just another way of being able to assist and help people get off the sidewalk.
Is that working?
It's working so far. I mean, nice. But, you know, you still have in those areas that really is going to take a rest because they have allowed it to be so rampant. Yeah. Like when Mayor Lurie got in, he cleaned up one area, but he sent it to another area. He cleaned up like the 6th Street corridor. Then they all went over to the Mission District, the 16th and Mission. And now it's starting to creep its ugly head again because they're still not arresting people. They're arresting people for selling drugs, but they're not arresting people for using drugs on the street.
Right.
And even because the point they were saying is that they're going to offer you treatment and help offer you the help you need. And if you refuse that, then you're going to have to go to custody. But no one's been arrested.
You think allowing people to use drugs on the streets because they're addicted is not compassion? That if you don't want
help. No, that's not compassion.
That's not compassion.
That's killing people. And especially, I'm not going to even call it a drug. Fentanyl is a poison. It's not even a drug. It's made in somebody's bathroom or kitchen sink or in somebody's barn. So it's nothing natural about that drug.
Yeah. So you are an elected official of the San Francisco Democratic Committee. So that's kind of a big deal.
Hey.
Stay humble as an elected official.
Let me tell you something. I had not a clue what this was. I had someone call me on the phone one day and it asked me, Cedric, you need to run for this. And I said, why do I need to run? Because, Cedric, you can run. Then the person was honest with me. He said, Cedric, there are no Black people that are running. We need some Black people running. And they were kind of like afraid to say it. But I said, if we're going to have a relationship with each other, you have to be able to say whatever it is you're saying. And I said, I'm not taking it anyway. I said, that's a fact. And we don't have to go any further with it. But anyway, yeah, I went out there, ran. I raised the least amount of money. I think I raised like $7,000 to $10,000. But what the thing was, I never asked for any money. People would just give me money. I never asked for a quarter. I just couldn't find it in myself to do it. And now that I'm in this politics, you know, that was another thing I said, God, you let me win this. You said I'm not talking about you enough. So I guess you're going to put me on the platform. I'm going to make me talk about you. And the other thing is politics. This is not, I'm not going to say corrupted. I'm going to say this. People lie. People are in it for themselves. I think most people come in for great intentions, but then they become lifetime politicians. So that means you spend your whole time raising money, coming up with weird propositions that don't mean nothing, meaningless propositions. And so I can raise more money that not necessarily in my name. And I promise you the world, because you're a voter, and I'll never see you again, and I'll never tell you the truth about what happened.
Wow, and this Cedric, has been... I think you're my favorite politician now.
Well, this has been like for me, some days I'll tell you honest, I wanted to stop. But one thing, this is where recovery comes in. I stick to my recovering people. I stick to them like glue, and I stick to God a lot more through this process because it's very difficult for me. And I can't be in something that's fake and phony. And something else that I know for certain, even when I was running, I made a commitment. A lot of things happen on Sunday mornings. A lot of events happen on Sunday mornings. But everything that I did before I ever thought about doing this, I continued to do. I was never going to miss church due to this. I never was going to miss none of my support groups, recovery support groups due to this. And everybody know now, even in the politics, If you want to find me on Sunday on certain days of the week, you know where I'm at.
Yeah.
So that's
and you kept your committing that. Your commitment to God. You mentioned him and you said it.
Yes.
I'm going to always do that. On this program, and I'm sure you do it at your meetings.
Yes. Yeah. And I pray. I do all those things that in San Francisco, who is almost against the law to do that.
Yeah. Good for you. And that's hard to do. I was going to ask you that. Here you are on this San Francisco Democratic politician, yet I hear you saying, you know, letting people using drugs is not compassion. It kills people. That's not something you usually hear from a Democrat.
Oh, no. And you don't hear it from my party at all. Because honestly, a lot of people don't realize it, but I look at Kamala Harris. I think she continued to send money to San Francisco. Nancy Pelosi continued to send money to San Francisco. But what I found out in politics, because I used to blame them for a lot of this that's happening now, even our governor, because he was mayor and allowed a lot of this to go on, permissiveness to go on. Mm-hmm. The money came, but it was who they were listening to. So they were listening to a lot of people that supported harm reduction and supported this process. And that's why, it'll be a day when I do get to see him. I mean, I did talk to Nancy Pelosi, but I never got a chance to talk to her exactly about that. But I do want to have those conversations because a lot of them are responsible for this. It's just not the people that's in positions now. A lot of them have supported this process and then act like it doesn't exist right now. So,
right. You know, I noticed that with the opioid prescription epidemic, you know, I was very clear as a physician that I was the problem of prescribing too many opioids and apologized and fixed that. And a lot of people apologize and fix that. The only people I heard never say they're sorry were the politicians.
No, they're not.
But
that means I have to tell the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're terrific. I'm so proud of you. And the way is you stick to the issues and your mission and forget about the politics. You just do what's right.
Yeah, I can't get involved in that's something else.
Right.
I made a commitment that I'm not going to put down nobody because that's why when I said that, I'm careful at how I say it so it don't look like I'm, you know, because everybody, human beings going to make mistakes and not going to live up to what the expectations are. But I don't have time for that because I'm on my grind every day. Serving and helping people, and that's what I do. So if you're not about that, or if we can find ways to work together, I'm good with that. But this, like I tell people in San Francisco, every time I speak, I said, whether you are actually responsible for the way the city looks right now or not, but I know you were responsible. If you didn't do nothing at all, you're responsible. But I do know this, that as a city, we have to pull it together and bring it back together as one, not divided.
Yeah.
We can have our differences, but we still need to work together. We got to quit pointing the finger at one another.
Beautiful. So you talked about Nancy Pelosi, Kamala Harris. If you had an opportunity to meet President Trump or our new upcoming drug czar, Sarah Carter, what would you want to tell them?
Trump, I don't really even, I mean, to
no,
me,
as far as the drug issue and recovery issues.
Well, let me say this, see, I like to talk to people who can make changes. You know, it's like, if you can make a change, yes. I mean, now I don't know that much about, how Trump works and how things happen. I know Trump says a lot of things, but what kind of got me now is we have had last president, and Trump is, to me, is in that same boat, that I don't really think they're making the decisions because of their age and the way their brain is working right now.
But so what would you want to see, Chip? What would you want? Whether well, they
what I mean, for me personally, is just first thing we have to do is bring our economy back to where we have to get people working and making sure and improve our school systems. Because it like, again, what we were talking about earlier about it starts with the children. We're going to have a generation now that can't read or write. All this generation does is walk down and with their head down looking at their phones. Their whole way of communication, I know it's changing. It's not like I'm trying to hold on to the past, but the way they communicate with each other is very impersonal. And when we have like these issues with substance use, high unemployment, and people don't have trades, it's going to be a whole lot of people in this generation that are going to be lost. And we need to bring some attention back to that instead of looking at the whole world in which we can't no longer run this world anymore because we have raped this world. And excuse that using that word, but that was first thing came to my head. Of all this resources, we have taken everything from other countries. And in America, we really are spoiled rotten. So we really need to focus on this country and be able to try to hold this country together. And, you know, it's almost like clean up your own house first before you can go out and say something to someone else. And they, I mean, it's the same for me personally. I can't go out and talk about nobody else if my house is in chaos. I just can't do it. And
that, interesting. You know, your focus is not about drug treatment or recovery or those issues that I thought that you would say. You're really going upstream to making the world better for children.
Well, you asked me what the real issues are. I mean, drugs is an issue, but sometimes for me, if we start taking care, because I'm trying to look at the future, the ones that sitting here today that are on drugs, I'm sure we can get them off of it. But please, doctor, since you're a doctor, don't come up with another drug to give to a person and say, this is going to be the key drug that's going to cure you. And it may cure you for the moment where you don't feel symptoms, but nothing can take that taste out of you unless you do the internal work yourself. Because like this drug that everyone's using right now, I forgot the name of it, to lose weight. That's going to be the next thing people are going to be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody going to be in a program for that. Because I even see so many people around me. I just see them. I say, are you on drugs? And all of them on it. And it's people who are not even overweight is on Ozempic. And that's what also, like, those are the things. When you want to talk about addiction, this is what this country has taught.
Yeah,
take a pill for everything.
We got some food addiction going on.
Yeah, we got a quick fix for everything. Yeah. And that's what has the, and that's what the brain be looking for. A quick fix, but it doesn't sustain you. So, I mean, yeah, but yeah, if I had that time to be able to talk, what the first thing I do though is like, I don't really have nothing to say to people. I have to listen to them and I have to get to know them. And that's what'll tell me whether it's even worth it to say it to them or not.
Worth the breath.
But yeah, but sometimes I have to meet people in order for that to open up doors for me to get through. To be able to bring other people through.
Yeah.
Such and that's how
wonderful.
I look at politics.
I'm proud of you. I'm so glad I got to have this conversation with you. May God bless you to give you continued strength to do exactly what you're doing and making your, you know, community better, one little sidewalk at a time.
That's it. One little crack in the sidewalk at a time.
One little crack in the sidewalk at a time. That's great. Bless you. Thank you so much.
Well, bless you and thank you. And thank you for this. Thank you for inviting me and giving me a platform to be able to discuss it. And don't let this be the end. We got to make sure that we work together in the future.
Amen.
Okay.
Very beautiful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.